everyone, and welcome to another episode of Planet Centered Care, a podcast about sustainable healthcare from the BMJ. I'm Lauren DeFreitas, a freelance clinical editor in the education section of the BMJ, and I'm joined by my co-host, Florence.
Hi everyone, I'm Florence Whitmore. I'm a sustainability fellow at the BMJ and a medical registrar in London.
Great, it's great to be here again, Flo. Our last episode was fantastic. It was great to meet our guests and hear their stories and what motivated them to do the work that they were involved in.
Yeah, totally. I really enjoyed last episode, and particularly I think that stuff around the kind of how we begin to get started, but also that, like, the fact that everybody has a really different viewpoint of this, and like how much it is about you kind of you going into your workplace and being like, oh, hang on a second, I'm seeing something unsustainable that no one else has seen. What can I do about it? And I guess kind of coming into this episode, there's a little bit more of the kind of what can I do about it stuff when we start to think about working with other people and collaboration and working with patients as well. So really, really looking forward to hearing more from our two guests today. But I'll let them quickly introduce themselves and then we can kind of hear a bit about their stories.
Hi there, I'm Nicola Wilson. I am a lead clinical educator at Great Ormond Street. So that means that I manage a team of educators across a range of different specialties. So they might teach you, say, for instance, how to put a child on hemodialysis, or teach you how to care for a child post brain tumour resection. So I manage that team and also obviously practically teach regularly myself.
Great, thanks, Nicola. And Maria?
Yes, I'm Maria Kweek from Holland, and I was a patient. I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was needed a breast amputation for it. And then, because I was an old nurse 30 years ago, 35 years ago now, and I was in shock about the huge amount of waste I created to get better. So I went to the management of the hospital and asked them to do something about this as an artist. And first it was no, and after a while he said yes, please do, because this is ridiculous. So I collected all the operation waste of my second operation. I got a breast reconstruction after my amputation, and I asked the surgeon for all the disposable waste for it. And when I woke up after 10 hours of anesthesia, they brought me 6 big bags full of disposable shit to my room, and I made a video of it, and the video went viral, and it's called "This is the waste of one operation, my operation." And I think it's still traveling around the world and world around and around, because every week I receive some mails, can we use your video, we want to work green. And I said, yes, of course. So I'm an old patient.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on and for joining us today. And, you know, particularly excited that Maria, you know, I think often in sustainable healthcare, the patient voice has been missing. So it's really great to have you here and kind of have somebody who's been a patient saying, wow, this is important. So to kind of get started, Nicola, do you want to tell us a little bit about kind of your story and how you started getting involved in sustainable healthcare?
Yeah, so I suppose it started with one reasonable size project about 5 years ago. And myself, the consultant nurse for infection control, Helen Dunn, and another educator, Amy Leonard. We started the Gloves Are Off project, and that came out of a range of different things, but basically us looking at our auditing of hand hygiene and just realising that gloves were one of the key reasons why people weren't decontaminating or washing their hands at the appropriate moment, because they were still wearing non-sterile gloves. So we did this project, or launched this project, to see if we could sort of encourage staff to risk assess better when they were using non-sterile gloves. And that led on to us saving so much plastic. It was incredible. Just even in that first year, we saved a phenomenal amount. And 5 years later, it's escalated again. And obviously, we've shared our project, as you should with all sustainability projects, shared it, and it's kind of gone international now, which is brilliant.
So you've both kind of gone viral in your own way.
I don't think mine's nearly as impressive when it comes to the imagery as Maria's, that's for sure. We measured our sort of plastic sustainability save in T-Rex, because we're a children's hospital. And so we were like, how many tons is a T-Rex and how many tons of plastic have we saved? And that imagery is kind of what people share is, you know, we've now saved 12.3 T-Rex in the last 5 years. We're only a very little hospital, but that imagery is very different to Maria's. Yeah.
Well, so my question is for Nicola. You know, when you got started in this project, how did people react to not wearing gloves? And specifically, how did patients react to seeing their clinicians not wearing gloves?
Good question. So lots of people reacted in different ways. Staff felt panicked at first because they had automatically worn gloves because they thought they were protecting their patients. And we should wear gloves to protect our patients, but that should be sterile gloves when we're doing a sterile procedure, not non-sterile gloves. They should only be worn if we're protecting ourselves from a bodily fluid. So once people got their mindset around that, that was absolutely fine because they felt that they were washing their hands more and they could understand the background, and we'd shared the research around it with them. Patients, Helen particularly actually went and sat in cubicles on our oncology ward and spoke to parents about what they were seeing, what they were observing, and they felt actually the feedback then was that they felt safer because they were watching staff wash their hands more. So that once they could see why we were making that change, they felt safer. And then from patients, we had this lovely feedback from one father of a patient who had learning disabilities. And his school had taken on the Gloves Are Off project after us. I don't know whether they'd named it the same thing or just that they'd taken on the principles. And anyway, that had really helped because he had, like most of our patients, you know, they see the colour of a nurse's uniform, but with him, they'd see the nurses put gloves on, or the staff in the school put gloves on, and that had been a trigger that something unpleasant might be about to happen. And so the fact that they were no longer wearing gloves meant that that trigger was taken away. So we've definitely had positive feedback from patients and families alike. Yeah,
that's really fantastic though. It's interesting there, beyond the plastic benefits and sustainable healthcare benefits, there were these really great patient benefits as well, because maybe we don't think about the impact that something that we might take for granted as simple as wearing gloves could actually have on some patients who have their fears. What wearing gloves means to them could mean something different to us.
Definitely. And there is a study in adult patients, not in pediatrics with us, but in adult patients, that says patients actually feel dirty when nurses go to give cares and they're still wearing gloves. They feel like there's something up with them from that perspective. And that's certainly not true. So it's nice to take those out of the equation.
And I'm interested, Nicola, so you kind of worked across a few different groups. You know, I think you're a nurse by kind of professional background, now you're an educator, but like this obviously affects all different staff across the hospital, across healthcare, and you also mentioned outside of healthcare even. Like, how was it kind of working, you know, you started with this change, you thought it's a good idea, but like trying to kind of change that and working across those different groups?
I think it's really easy in a hospital when you first start something to forget the other groups. But we were lucky. I know that sounds awful, but you often stay siloed in your own profession, right? So with, you know, the initial kind of stage, and I think the reason this project particularly worked is because we'd reached out to as many different groups across the trust as possible. So I'd even gone down and talked to the porters. We'd talked to the cleaning staff. We'd talked to all the different healthcare professionals, but equally outside that box as well. And going to teach porters, they just love it. I guess because they do get forgotten about a lot of the time, but they're so key. You know, how often do you see a porter pushing a bed, still wearing gloves, and then touching the lift button and everything else? They're still part of that infection trail, and it's really important that we encourage everyone to take ownership of that. Yeah.
Marie, you're nodding. But I guess probably before we hear from you, we should probably describe to our listeners what the video is and what it looks like. And it's really impactful when you see it. And I'm probably going to do a very poor job of describing it. But what Maria does is she takes all of the everything that was used, everything that would have been thrown away from her operation, and kind of lays it out on the floor in this sort of spiral around her, and then goes and lies in the middle of it, which is a very, very poor description of something. But you know, do go and have a look at it online, and we'll put the link in the show notes. So Maria, coming back to you.
Yes, I will. You have to know I am an artist for, I think, 20 years now, and taking my subject is always waste, so it's not very strange. I was really surprised about the huge amount of waste I created in the hospital, and also I was a nurse, I told you, 30, 35 years ago. And if I compare those periods, it's completely different. So for me it was like, what is going on? What happened during the time I was not working on the hospital? And even just about the gloves, it's unbelievable. I was lying in my bed and I asked, can you close the the curtains, please? And I put on the gloves and closed the curtains. I said, why are you wearing gloves? Yes, we get used to it. It's normal. We have to. All that kind of stuff. And the only thing I was doing as a very, maybe... They didn't like me all as a patient, because I only was asking again and again, why is this? Why is there a plastic disposable plate for a cookie, a packed cookie for me? Why are all the glasses from disposable plastics? And every time you saw the people thinking, yeah, maybe she's right, you know? They get used to it. And that's the problem, I think. I was when they cut my bandage in two pieces after the day after the first operation, I found my scissors back in the waste bin, and I took them off and brought them to the nurse and said, here are your scissors, because in my time when I was a nurse long time ago, we were used to wear our scissors and some Vaseline just in your uniform, that's all. And if we were using gloves, it was only because it was the patient was incontinent, but not gloves anytime. So for me, it's like I was asking it again and again. And when I asked the surgeon for collecting the waste, she said it's a quite unusual question. I've never had this question before. I thought, yeah, I can imagine. But she said, I totally agree. You know, she said, everything is packaged. Why? So it starts with a question, why is this? And not like in the aggressive style of, I don't want it. No, you have to ask it. And then people will think about it. If I was laying in as a patient in bed like, I don't want all these plastic shit, then all the nurses will go in the defense, you understand? And that they're so used to it, they don't ask themselves anymore. And just the gloves, unbelievable. Every time they put on the gloves, why? So that's why I was so concerned. But I was a patient, but also I was an ex-nurse. You have to remember that. So I can compare it with 30 years ago with now. And that not everything is going better during the time. Sometimes things are going more worse, I think, like the plastic disposables.
I just want to say that actually when I got first involved in climate change and health and sustainable healthcare, your video was one of the first that I saw. So I always have that video in my mind with all of the plastic waste around you. But I'm just curious, as a patient, are you working on your own, or do you have a group of other patients who work together to help bring awareness?
So I'm an artist and I work on my own, and I'm always concerned about climate change, and I want to create awareness like that. So when I was a patient, I suddenly became a patient. It was not a choice, of course, to become a patient. I was a patient from one day at the other. So I'm still the same. It's not about my breast cancer. All the videos are not about my breast cancer. They're just asking a question. Is there another way? And I think that's the answer. I'm just concerned about the whole situation.
Maria, can I ask you, you said you were concerned about climate change before this. What was the trigger that got you concerned before becoming a patient?
There was a crisis in 2008 and I had no work because nobody needed me. And then I was invited by a friend of mine to come over to Sierra Leone. And when I came there, my first visit on the beaches of Freetown, I was completely in shock because there I saw for the first time the plastic soup. And I realized the plastic soup comes from the West and not from them by themselves. It's just our pollution. So I came back and I was really ashamed about that. And then I promised myself to commit all my art to create awareness about trash, litter, plastic soup, all the kind, because that's my language. And it works, because I made big community art works. I collected always a lot of waste with the community. And then we made big sculptures. I was welding, and welding a frame, and then they covered it with plastic bottles or cans or whatever, and then we had a big elephant or a big rhino, we made a big rhino, just to show the same trash. Normally you won't look at it because you don't want to pay attention to that kind of trash or litter because it's dirty, it has no identity. But if you give it identity to change it into a beautiful elephant or whatever, a sculpture, then it's art. And then people will look at it and say, oh wow, this is great, beautiful. But they don't realize at the first moment they're watching litter, trash, you know? And then it opens the heart and then they will make their own conclusion. Oh shit, this is all the litter from this suburb or from... And then they will think, oh shit, this is really a problem. It's the same as my video. You're still watching a lot of trash, but it's because it's surrounding me and so and so. So that's my way, how I work and how it came.
I just find that really fascinating because I'm always trying to get people on board at work around sustainability, different sustainability projects, and everyone has a different trigger point. Everyone has something else that will bring them into that world or reach their level of concern. And so for you, it was they're seeing the plastic in the ocean. And it's just, I am constantly thinking, okay, I wonder what my message is going to be to this member of staff to get them on board with the next project. You know, what's going to be their tipping point to encourage them in that way?
And on that point, Nicola, how much do you make it sustainability the first message, or how much are you kind of like the stuff you started off with, gloves off, that like there's loads of patient safety, there's money, you know, there's that kind of emotional aspect that we talked about that kind of everybody was coming up to you with purple hands, you know, do you put sustainability always at the front of this, or are you kind of mixing up depending on the staff you're kind of working with and so on?
Yeah, completely. Mix it up depending on the staff. If you're talking to the exec team, and I don't mean anything bad about this, but you talk finance, right? Because it's them that has to answer to that. If you're talking to the frontline workers, you talk about how it's going to impact your care and your patient's care. So me as a nurse, I'm often thinking about it because I'm a pediatric nurse and I'm just worried about the next generation. I'm looking at these kids that we're caring for now and feeling, gosh, we're setting them up to fail here. We're not taking our responsibility seriously enough, and we're curing all sorts of horrendous diseases and ailments within these children. But to what avail? What are we setting them up? What future are they going to have? And I take that as a frontline worker really, really seriously. The Gloves Are Off project was fascinating because we'd started it from a care perspective, but once we started feeding it back because we knew the quantities of plastic and were feeding that back, actually it was amazing how that snowballed and how interested staff were in that sustainability aspect. But now, yeah, I mean, if I talk about air pollution, then it's talking about the stories that relate to the clinician that you're talking to.
And I also wanted to pick up on something Maria said about how she wasn't a patient first, and I think there's something in there, isn't there, like that's really interesting about how we kind of, as healthcare professionals, I don't want to tar everyone on the same brush, but like, you know, we sometimes kind of put like, oh well, will patients as though they're, you know, one big group of people like care about this or not, but obviously people are people first, and you know, we expect people to care about this outside, you know, everybody's doing something outside of healthcare. And yes, you know, we don't want to like be detrimenting anybody's care because we're making these considerations, but I think it's, you know, it's presumptuous to think that people wouldn't care. They're caring outside before they become in and, you know, sit in your clinic or in a bed in your A&E department or whatever.
Yeah, we have a young people's forum and they are very vocal about sustainability, and they would hold us to account much higher than most of the clinicians would, definitely. They know it's their future, and they're brilliant at challenging us, 100%.
Yeah, I think that's all of these stories are really fascinating, and it's really interesting the different approaches that you take, both of you have taken, to bringing awareness to the topic. And it's not always just about in-your-face sustainability, but it is the other aspects of whatever it is you're trying to tackle, and speaking each other's language. So as Nicola said, a different approach depending on which group you're talking to. And then, as Maria said, she already had that interest. And then Flo, you're saying, yes, we're all people. We're people to start with, just normal people to start with. You know, so yeah, tapping into that who is that person I'm talking to perspective is a good way, I guess, to bring across the point.
I remember chatting to, I've got some friends who are kind of proper eco-warriors. It's going to be a surprise to say I've got those sort of friends. But they had a child who's born with a disability, and so spent lots of time in healthcare and kind of had all the thoughts, you know, that Maria has, and stuff like the, so their child had to be NG fed for a while, and they were saying that they went into, you know, in hospital every time they put in a feed there was a new like syringe, whereas they're like, but like if she was having a bottle at home, you'd obviously just sterilize the bottle. Like, I don't know, that just makes me think of all these things, like that people bring that to it, and it's, yeah, how you question it, as Maria says, the kind of asking why. But
I think that that's actually really important. The asking why part is something that we shouldn't be afraid to do. As Maria said, she went in and she asked her why, and you don't do it in a rude or disrespectful way, you're just asking why. And maybe that's something that we can all take away and encourage ourselves and others to do, just ask why.
I mean, just as we're kind of finishing off, I guess, this discussion element, I wondered if there's ever been times for either of you, Maria and Nicola, whether there's been times when, like, I feel we've painted all this quite a rosy spin at the moment, you know, like, everybody, you just have to find the right message, everybody on board and so on. But are there any, Nicola is shaking her head, like, are there any times when it hasn't gone down so well for either of you? And like, what, like, how has it been in those moments, and what have you done, yeah, encountering that?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I guess you get known in an organisation for being the person that will often bring a sustainability stance to something or question something in that way. So it's really hard not to then feel like you appear like the difficult person. And I think that, you know, sometimes people will be like, oh, is she a cardigan wearing vegan? Of which I'm neither. Alas, I probably should be both. And you feel that it comes with this prejudgment, right? And so when you question, you kind of almost feel, and I don't know if it's my own perception, that sort of imposter syndrome aspect, but you almost feel an eye roll when you question something, because you are often that voice. And so much so that I was speaking to someone from another trust recently, and they said they'd written their green plan, but taken the word green out because it was just the hospital plan, right? And it stops that niching and that putting us in that corner of this being other. It's an extra thing that we have to do, or it's something different. It's not, it should just be our daily routine. It should be a question that we're always asking each other. Did I need to use that? Was that something that is now just becoming waste? And I think that's quite interesting to see that people are already taking that tack to say, wow, so we don't get the eye roll when we walk in that room. How else are we going to pitch it? And that's quite tricky. And I do quite a lot of sustainability teaching in the Trust. And so one of the first things I do is one of those dreaded icebreakers. But I put pictures up around a room. You know what I mean. I mean, it could only be surpassed by saying I did role play, which I haven't done. But, you know, start with an icebreaker. And I put pictures around the room and I put, you know, monks scream, or I put some meerkats with their head in the sand, or ostrich with their head in the sand. And various different images. And I just ask people to stand next to what they're feeling around climate, because you need to pitch it. You need to pitch. And sometimes you can talk to a whole room of people where you've got one person with massive eco anxiety, but the other people are like, oh yeah, that's someone else's job. You know, and so how do you pitch those teaching sessions? How do you bring that into your normal conversations and allow us to question and challenge? It's fascinating. It's a whole world of behavioural change. Yeah.
If you want to change something in behaviours, you always have to keep in mind that you will meet the resistance against it, because you ask why and people like, me? Are you talking about me? Yes, I'm talking about you. So I get used to it. And also, a lot of people are afraid for change. They say no already. No, I don't want to change because it's frightening. I've made 5 videos, and the first one was my own, of course, and I made one of a childbirth, and I always had to deal with resistance from the communication part of the hospital, or the head of the, especially the communication part. They're so afraid to bring something new out, and especially if it's about a change in behavior, just to make less disposable or less waste, or just you have to do, you have to take your responsibility for it. People are afraid for it. So, yes. And sometimes it makes me really, really, tired. And why I'm doing this, always calling, phoning, emailing, etc., etc., just to get through it. But for me, it's so important to tell them about the future and why it's so necessary. I deal with it. I don't like it, but I have to deal with it. So, you know, you meet the resistance of the other side. And yeah, take it. It's a part of the deal.
I think one of the resistance that I had come across, I realized that actually the person I was talking to wasn't so interested in the sustainability saves. Of various different projects, but the social aspect. And when you hear people talking about where our medical equipment is produced and what the labour is like around how that's produced, and you think about actually us in this privileged position having access to this healthcare, but using things that are produced by people that aren't in the same privilege. And actually that's been really quite interesting, how with some people I might not talk about the plastics or the production of those plastics and the embodied carbon or something, but I might talk about the social aspect around the production of those plastics. And that sometimes taps into people's ability to kind of join in and be a part of the projects. Yeah.
Just one thing I want to ask Nicola, it was the influence of the pandemic. How did that affect your campaign and convincing people or helping people to stop wearing the gloves? And the patients as well, because maybe they had the same perspective that their clinicians should be wearing gloves because we're in a pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, firstly,
and then post-pandemic,
I'm at some point wanting to not be synonymous with the Gloves Are Off project, and I will share more projects as we go.
Right.
It's like, I'm slowly finding that I'm known as the Gloves Lady, and that's slightly tricky 5 years later. there is so much more that we could do. Yeah, no, it's cool. It's absolutely cool. There is so much more that we can do. Watch this space. But you're right to ask about the pandemic. You know, that initial stage, even so much that when I got redeployed in the initial stage of the pandemic, because I'd worked so closely with Helen on this project, our director for education was like, Nicola, we need you to go and work with the infection control team. And you know, when you're like, oh, okay. okay, I've ridden the rod for my own back there, haven't I? So I was ever her wingwoman, that's fine. But no, in those initial stages, people were so full of anxiety. Our behaviours weren't necessarily... They were fueled often by the anxiety that we had in that first stage, weren't they? And I think it's really hard for us to relate back to it now because we hear people say, oh, I've got COVID or COVID. And it's just not in the same place that it brings about that adrenaline and that cortisol and that high level of emotion as well. And we were seeing, you know, every Friday night, the government bringing out a different policy around how we needed to stay safe in the hospital. And, you know, by Monday, people were anxious that we hadn't yet implemented it. And so it's hard to relate back to that. But the initial times, you know, when the government was saying, you know, you've got to wear this PPE and do it in this format, you have to follow that. You absolutely have to follow that because the world was still learning about COVID and what the best methodology was. So we did. And we did have an increase in gloves use around that time. Just like if you open a new part of a hospital and have an additional wards, the procurement team will procure more gloves in preemption for those wards opening, that kind of thing. But what we found crucially is when the guidance related far closer to what we'd originally set and went back to a baseline, actually our staff moved really sharply back to normal and back to a gloves are off, because when we'd brought about the change, we'd made sure they understood why we did it, so they knew the rationale behind the behaviours, and so for them it was a natural baseline to go back to. That makes sense. Okay. Yeah, well, and we've definitely followed that in our statistics. We've definitely followed that through. Right. So I would say if you're making a behaviour change, make sure that it's not just the comms team putting up posters or doing screensavers. Make sure staff understand why you're doing that. What's the rationale for it?
The question of why will always come up, I think. It's really important.
It's impressive, because I don't know about you, Lauren, but like, I didn't see that where I worked post-COVID. Like, people just normalized that gloves had to be worn for everything. And like, what's your experience?
Yeah, kind of similar, I think. So yeah, the certain things continued. So, and gloves just happens to be one of the most common things, right? And because my setting is an emergency setting, you will see a lot of people wearing gloves all the time. But it wasn't just the clinicians. It was the auxiliary staff as well who were still carrying on with some of these habits. And so listening to both of our guests talk has given me a lot of ideas about how to approach this. Because, you know, I just wasn't sure, like, how do you get people to stop wearing it now? How do you explain that to them? How do you understand why they think it's still necessary, you know? But yeah, I don't think it's not as smooth as Nicola has described in her setting. A lot more challenges, I think, for me. And Maria, did you see anything in terms of the waste and the level of waste related to that?
I think, yes, of course, it increased incredible. It's also a feeling of safe. If you wear your mask and you wear your gloves, people feel safe in not to get COVID. And it's a kind of symbol. Yeah, but I was always also thinking about, not only about COVID, but if you want to change something, a lot of people think that to change in normal habits, it's really, really difficult to do. And I told you already, you always have to deal with the resistance of your community. No, I don't want to change, but we have to. So keep that in mind, but also keep it simple to change, because about your glove awareness, you have to keep the message simple. And also collaborate. That's also very simple. Don't stand on your own and say, I want to change the world, I want to save the world on my own. Impossible. So collaborate with a lot of people with the same way of thinking. And always say to people, just do it. Just start. Just do it. If you're not, it's so simple. So for me, it's a big lesson. Please try, just do it. Like Nicolai, it's the same. Just start. Stay positive and always ask yourself, why not? Or why?
Nicola, That was fantastic, Maria. I think you gave us some great advice there and what you were saying about just start, just try and keep asking why. Definitely good points for us to take away, I think. And Nicola, any pieces of advice? If there was one piece of advice that you could give us or to take away from this?
Well, I probably have multiple top tips, but I would probably agree with Maria about the collaboration. You know, change shouldn't just come out of one silo within a healthcare setting. This worked because we worked with so many people and we involved all our stakeholders right from the beginning, all the people that we thought would be our biggest challenges. We involve them and we ask them, you know, what do you think about this change? What are the things that bring up problems or concerns to you? And actually being able to answer their questions right from the beginning really helped. And it meant that the people that we thought would be barriers actually came along the ride with us and kept pushing us to do more. That was really good. Also, I think it's not me. I didn't personally save 12 T-Rex worth of gloves. There's no way I could put that many on. But it's about the staff and it's about saying thank you to them. And when you give feedback, just saying thank you because you're the ones doing this. You're the ones making this change. And thank you for being a part of it. It's not Great Ormond Street. It's every single member of staff that has gone about that change that's done it. Yeah,
we should probably round off. I've really enjoyed today's discussion, and I've got one last question for Laura and us saying that we're about to round off, but you mentioned when Maria was talking that was one of the first, her videos were one of the first things you saw when you started to get involved in thinking about sustainable healthcare. Like, what was the impact on you of seeing those videos?
It was actually a shock. Because the first time I saw it, I mean, I was really, really new to it. This was, just in the start of the pandemic, and that was when I was now getting involved. And I don't remember how I even came across the video. I just know I saw the video and this person lining up the waist, like all of that. Obviously, I've not worked in surgery for years, but it just never occurred to me that we could use that much waste. And it did make me think, what are we doing in different departments? Because yes, it's a surgical operation, so it's going to be a lot more than on other things that we do. But it really was just shock that the amount of things that we use for what we might consider something routine. Yeah, so it was the start of that whole thought process of what are we doing?
Well, I'm glad we've been able to bring you two together through the podcast, because that's really lovely.
And maybe to for you, I'm completely healthy now. I have no cancer. I'm just a healthy person. I'm not a patient at all. And I'm really flattered to hear you in shock. So the video worked.
It did. And first of all, really glad to hear that you are cancer-free now. And really just impressed that even in that moment of, undergoing everything that you were dealing with, the surgeries and whatnot, and dealing with breast cancer, that you still had the presence of mind to look at waste and the impact that it was having. Because I'm not sure many of us would do that. You know, I might just be thinking about myself and what I'm experiencing, but you were still looking at the bigger picture in that moment. So that's why.
But it's really funny because I can tell you a funny story about it. Because after the breast amputation of mine, I came back to the room and my husband and my daughter were sitting there with crying faces. Oh, mama's coming back like this. But I felt really good, you know. I felt like the cancer's gone. I felt it. And so I was quite optimistic, and also because of all the morphine and whatever. So, but I came back to the room, in the bedroom, and I said, I'm okay, I'm just fine. So I'm going to do something about all these plastic disposables, because that's ridiculous. And my daughter was like, oh, mama, please, 10 minutes, not saving the world, please. So, yes, but that's me, because I'm always working. It's not the first time I'm working with waste. It's just because I became a patient. This is, that's why.
That's really lovely. And I just, to finish this off, I wanted to say that, like, in your kind of advice to other people, it's been really, like, there's been loads of echoes from what we've heard from other people. I think, we had people saying exactly the same thing last time, like, just start, collaborate. And I think we've had loads of really great tips about how to collaborate across different groups and kind of starting to think about those messaging. And actually thinking about the messaging is something we're going to come back to in a future episode. Is there one thing you're going to take away from today, Lauren?
Definitely. I think normalizing it, actually, that's sort of the message I was hearing, is normalizing it. So you don't have to push the same message or the same wording to everybody. You don't have to push, okay, this is about saving the planet, or this is about sustainable healthcare, or this, we need to make our workplaces more green. You have to use their language and what they will understand. And I think that's important, because sometimes you do have the tendency that you just want to make that point that this is about sustainability and climate change. But not everybody's going to understand that language. So just speak the language that they are speaking, and you'll still get the same point across, and you'll make the same changes if you meet them where they are. And the second thing is just the why. I really like the asking the why and just questioning things, not just asking them to make them think, but it's also about understanding where people are and where they're coming from in their actions and behaviors, because it's going to help you to come up with the correct approach as well. And what about you, Flo? Anything that you took away?
I don't know. I love the asking why. I mean, that is it, isn't it? It's the kind of, you know, just, it's a gentle challenge, isn't it? Like, why do you do it like that? And they're thinking about kind of culture change and what, like, why we behave. All of us bringing out our inner toddler with endless why. Great. Well, I think we could carry on talking for ages, but it's been a really lovely conversation, and thank you so much to Maria and Nicola for joining us, and for kind of taking the time and for sharing your stories, and for actually just for everything you do, because actually I think there'll be lots of people who are really inspired by what you're doing. And thank you to all of our listeners for listening to this episode of Planet Centre Care, the BMJ's podcast on sustainable healthcare. Do keep an eye out for our future episodes. As we've mentioned, some of the themes that are going to be coming up, particularly kind of how we communicate, but lots more stories of clinicians like you getting involved, making a change in their workplace. You can also check out lots of the climate related content on the BMJ's website. And we've also got the Net Zero Clinical Care Conference coming up this October, which you can still register for online attendance. So thank you again to our guests and to Lauren, and look forward to seeing you next time.